This is the Auntie M Brain Tumors Talk Show. It's a show full of informative chat and inspirational messages. The Auntie M Brain Tumors Talk Show on podcast.
Hello, is that Chris?
Yes, it is. Hi, Claire.
If we go back, what has led you to brain tumors?
I've always had an interest in cancer. Right through my primary degree and my master's, everything I was picked up when I heard cancer being mentioned, and I done my master's degree in a cancer field. I think where it really came from then was about drug delivery. I also had a real interest in drug delivery. So I ended up doing a PhD in drug delivery, but actually it was in HIV prevention. So it was producing vaginal rings for women in sub-Saharan Africa to be able to protect themselves, to give them women control protection against HIV. And that's where I was interested in that they were trying to deliver peptides and proteins. So I was interested in that. Then when I started out on my sort of independent academic career, I decided I want to go back into oncology. I want to do drug delivery. So we were using novel techniques like hot melt extrusion and injection molding and 3D printing to produce these rings for giving us things that we couldn't do with traditional pharmaceutical manufacturing. So I wanted to take that into oncology. And really, for me, the two cancers I mainly focus on are brain tumors and pancreatic cancer. And those are the two that we haven't really improved any survival in the last 40 years. We haven't really offered much. And to me, it's a drug delivery issue. So that's why I probably got focused on the brain tumors, because I did initially look at cervical cancer when I started out. But I was told, look, the survival rate for cervical cancer, if it's caught early and the current standard of care, is well above 90%. I looked around and I thought, actually, the blood-brain barrier is a massive problem when it comes to brain tumors. But we actually go in surgically. We do go in. It's pretty much the standard of care that we go in surgically. So I decided that's why I'm probably going. That's a good place to start drug delivery. That's where we can make a difference. And I have a sort of a mantra within my lab is that we have good drugs. We just choose to deliver them inefficiently. So for example, I mentioned the cervical cancer example. You know, the cervix has a huge blood supply. And there was a study done in the early 1990s where they looked at interarterial cisplatin. So using the arteries to deliver cisplatin. But ultimately what came out of that, they showed that less than 1% of the dose that was administered reached the cervical cancer. So they actually took biopsies of the tumor at the cervix and then looked for what drug was there. And that to me was a huge shock. I knew from a drug delivery pharmacology, pharmacodynamics, where by drugs going around the body, I knew that not all of the drug gets to where it needs to be. But I was shocked to find that it was somewhere in sub 1%, which meant that 99.9% of that high dose of cisplatin went to the lining of the stomach. It went to them. Patients were sick. It went to the liver and really not doing its job. And when you take that then to brain tumors, it's even less because of the blood brain barrier.
Yeah.
So we're developing all these novel drugs and we're looking at these new innovations, but actually they're not going anywhere because we can't get them into the brain. And so that's really what got me interested and said, actually, I do drug delivery. I develop implantable devices.
Malcolm Stevens and his team bring together the temozolomide. Is the drug that you're doing, is it better?
So we have taken a drug, a well-known established drug called Irinotecan. It's a standard chemotherapy drug. It's off patent. It's generic. It's cheap. And what we have done is we have formulated that in plant to deliver it locally. So now I had from Cancer Research UK, from other people, why don't you deliver temozolomide locally? And the simple answer to that is because it will be a disaster. Because look at what happened with the Gliadel wafers. That drug, that carmistine drug, was based off, it comes from mustard gas. It's an anti-drug. Put that in the brain and you damage the brain, you get all sorts of side effects. You get it with healing issues. So for temozolomide, that's an oral drug that's taken as a pill or a capsule that's swallowed and then dissolves in the stomach, is absorbed in bloodstream, and then gets pumped around the body. It's pumped through the brain, but the blood-brain barrier stops that going in. So it's there designed to keep things out of the brain from our blood system, stop blood going into the brain and carrying things we don't want there. And it stops the drug going in. Now, the thing with temozolomide and why it's it's probably used is because it crosses the blood-brain barrier more than most drugs. Now, there's arguments somewhere between 18 and 30% is how much crosses. Now, pre-pandemic, I was at a pediatric brain tumor meeting in London. And I was probably a bit low at this point because I was struggling with funding. People kept pushing me back to temozolomide. I did take a stand. I don't want to formulate temozolomide into my implant. It'll be a disaster. It's not going to work. It's going to do more harm than good. And I was at a pediatric oncology meeting. And that morning, I listened to about 10 presentations, all on temozolomide. Mm. And it was a bit like a pandemic. Oh, yes, it does. Oh, no, it doesn't. Oh, this is the blood-brain barrier. Oh, yes, it does. And then another group, oh, no, it doesn't. That other group were trying to tweak its chemistry to make it go across the blood-brain barrier. So that was fine. I was sitting there listening to this assess. And then in the afternoon, this lady came in whose son had a brain tumor. Mm. Now, unfortunately, he was diagnosed at 10. I think he died around maybe 13, 14. Unfortunately, at this point, he had already passed a number of years, and the lady was giving a talk about his life and showed the photographs of him during treatment and the swelling and the side effects in the bedroom. And what he then talked about how he could no longer swallow the temozolomide capsules. And she went to the oncology nurse. Says, look, he can no longer swallow those. What do we do? And she says, look, you can open up the capsules, you can pour them into orange juice. But to do that, you need to be double masked, double gloved, and double gowned. And the mother was like, well, why? And the nurse said, this drug is so toxic. That's why your son has swelling and has all these side effects. It's not the tumor. It's the treatment. Mm-hmm. And she referred to it as medieval treatment. Hers in the back of my neck stood up and I started to get goosebumps. And I was like, you know something? I can't give up on this. We have to do it better. So what we done is, so we then, at that time, were focused on NRTCan. It's because I was involved on the sidelines in a clinical trial with Professor Garth Cruickshank from the University of Birmingham, where I'm an associate professor. Mm-hmm. And Garth took the drug irinotecan, took 9 patients, and injected the drug into the resection margin after he removed the tumor in recurrent glioblastoma patients where we don't have a standard of care treatment. Now, the results of that came through. Efficacy was as good as probably what was the glioma, but we couldn't make any comparisons because it was only 9 patients with no statistics. And again, I was a typical sort of drug delivery person, pharmacy person. You're looking for the effect of the drug. Is it working? And we weren't really seeing that. But what Gyar said to me, what I'm excited about is the no toxicity. He goes, that is unbelievable. So the problem was the drug only hung about for maybe 2 days in the brain. We needed it there for at least 3, probably 5, because the drug works on day 3 of the cell cycle. Hmm. So Gyar then said to me, can you formulate that into an implant? And I went, yes. And we then chemo seed with irinotecan in the as the active to go in directly. So to go back slightly, when you talk about the comparison to temozolomide, yes. Linked to the Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Birmingham, one of the biggest brain tumor centers in the UK, I have access to primary tissue from patients. Mm. So when the surgeons remove a tumor, they can remove it on a Monday morning, they could be in my lab on Monday afternoon. They'll be ready, they'll ring my team, they'll go and collect it. And we test drugs on that tumor. Mm. And we can also get the margin tissue in certain patients. If the margin's accessible, we can take the margin, which is ultimately what we need now. We leave that margin tissue behind. That's what we're treating with chemotherapy after the patient has had the surgery. Now, in all the tests we have done, temozolomide is coming out near the bottom. So irinotecan is far better. We're testing, we're looking at repurposing drugs. We're testing statin drugs and different drugs and really cheap and expensive drugs that are off patent. So our thinking is we could offer a cheap treatment that will get up, what will be nice approved, that everybody will have access to it. And they won't have to fly to Germany like these vaccines in yes. South America and pay hundreds of thousands to get access to them. Mm-hmm. We want something that will be cheap and be able to be approved. So what we're saying, so temozolomide comes out near the bottom, but because it crosses the blood-brain barrier, it's when it goes into clinic, it worked better than the other dose because it would cross the blood-brain barrier. So the logic to that would be actually, why not just deliver the drugs locally? We're there anyhow. We go in surgically. Mm. It's not, people say to me, oh, but it's an invasive approach. Yes, but we're doing the surgery anyhow. The margin is exposed, so we have to deliver the drug locally. Now, that's been tried. The problem is carmistine was a disc. The carmistine wafers were a disc shape. They were just dropped and set into the cavity and balanced up against the side of the wall. And in some instances, they fall over, and the drug doesn't penetrate deep enough. So if you think of a brain tumor, particularly a high grade glioma, so grade 3 and 4, so your glioblastomas, if you think of those, we can take out the solid tumor, but it's the root that penetrate deep into the brain tissue that we can't take out, the surgeons can't remove. And they could be up to 10 millimeters deep, but the drug from these, if you just set them in the cavity, it only diffuses through that tissue, maybe 5 millimeter. So you're missing that deep-seated tumor tissue, and that's what's coming back. And it's getting probably exposed to low levels of the drug, subtherapeutic levels. So it's building up a resistance. And when it comes back, it's now resistant and we can't treat it. So what we have done is, we have taken NRT. So how we're different approach, we've taken NRT. We know the drug is safe, that phase 1 trial. The regulators are happy with that. And we're taking a well-known polymer, a bioavailable polymer that's been in the brain, either approved. And we've done this deliberately because we want this thing to be cheap and we want it to go to patients quickly. Mm. And we formulated them together and we formulated them into a cylinder, something that's similar size to a grain of rice. Now, when the surgeon removes the tumor, these are then injected into the tissue so that don't sit in the cavity. They're not like the gels or the paste or the wafers that are being used that have to sit in the cavity. These are a biopsy needle or a catheter is inserted into the tissue and the seed is implanted about 3 millimeter below the surface. So why 3 millimeter? Because we know we give therapeutic concentration of drug from our implant out to 5 millimeter. So we're being a bit conservative and saying, we'll go 3 millimeter. We'll not push it to the edge. We'll definitely cover all tissue. So it's 3 millimeter deep and they're 6 millimeter long. And they diffuse, I say, 3 to 5 millimeter away. So we're getting somewhere in the region of about 12 millimeter depth. So we have taken the drug. The drug has been locally administered using a gel formulation, very simply, to assess its safety. Mm-hmm. And we know the drug is safe in the brain. That was key. That's the first thing, because it takes quite a bit to develop the implant. There's a lot around manufacturing that we had to do. There was a lot around development. So we developed it and we've done all our preclinical mouse models and it works. So we have done all the preclinical work. We have funded the technology transfer, which doesn't sound exciting, but basically words come out of my lab and went to a pharmaceutical manufacturer and they can now manufacture the implant at scale. We've scaled all the manufacturing up. We've produced what's called the Good Laboratory Practices batch, which is under really strict clean room conditions, which again is, people don't realize, is one thing making something on a bench. There's another thing when you have to move to a clean room and specialized isolators and trying to do that. We have done all of that. And then the last step is sterilization. And we've sterilized ours, which is where a lot of things fail because you have to use radiation to sterilize it. And we've sterilized ours and it all looked good. We are now looking to go into the clinic. We've designed the clinical trial. We're working with the Tessagel Brain Matrix program, and we've designed and costed a trial. We are sitting in this bit in the middle, and we cannot get any funding to take us across that valley of death.
Who do you feel this will benefit the most, adults, children, or both?
We feel both. We feel both. That, but from a development strategy, we're deliberately targeting high-grade glioma adult patients where pretty much every patient gets surgery. The reason we're going, so we did talk about putting in grade 2, which I suppose is lower grade, and depending on how it's classified, it could fall into high grade. But we're really focusing on grade 3 and grade 4 patients. And it's just quite simple. It's a logistical reason. Because our clinical trial, we know that anyone recruited into the clinical trial who's a grade 3 or grade 4 will most likely definitely have surgery, unless the tumor is inoperable. Mm. But more than likely, they will have surgery. Not all grade 2s get surgery. But our hope is that we show this positive data. We're not seeing any toxicity issues in the phase 1 study. So the patients don't get the typical diarrhea, vomiting, weight loss, and all the stuff that comes with the drug when you deliver locally, because you're delivering what's called a high local dose. It's 1,000 times lower getting into the bloodstream. So it's not, so all the drug is at 1,000 times lower in the bloodstream typically, but you're giving a really high local dose to the tumor rather than going the other way where we give a really high blood level dose and cause all the toxicity, but only get a small amount of the tumor. We're going the other way. So our goal is to get 6 months overall increased survival with no toxicity, giving patients better treatments. Now, we do require surgery for this to work. But ultimately, what we believe is once we start getting the clinical data and we do, if we achieve that 6 months, no toxicity, there will be this pull from the clinical community for this to move into other patients. And we believe that this would benefit all patients, all brain tumor patients, right from low grade, right to high grade, where surgery may happen, and also children. And looking at the possibility of this being implanted directly into a tumor, we actually feel it would actually benefit a lot more cancer patients where you have a solid tumor like bladder, prostate, liver, lung, breast. This approach would actually roll out, but ultimately we want to focus on brain tumors for the simple reason it's not like any other cancer. The treatment options currently available are limited, and there's nothing in the clinical pipeline that's coming through.
If people wanted to do some kind of fundraising, how much are you trying to raise at the moment?
We're trying to raise approximately $700,000. We are trying to raise it at the moment. And what we need that money for is the biocompatibility study. It's around £400,000. Just we then need about $100,000 on top of that for regulatory support. So we need to bring in these consultants who can write the documentation that the MHRA understand, who can complete the online portal and put all our data in and turn it into tables and graphs that the MHRA understand. They're really good. Paper area, you need these people with these expertise so they can turn my development speak into regulatory speak that the regulators understand. And then we need to get a final batch of the implants, this GLP batch, which is around 140,000. So we've produced a small GLP batch and we've done all of that. And we've tested all of that, but that batch is gone because we had to test it in the lab and make sure it's fine. So we just need to get our CDMO, our contract manufacturer, to produce the GLP batch for the toxicity study. So it has to be done at that, what we call good laboratory practice level. And that's really what we're looking for. And what that does is that would be, that money gets us what we call clinical trial ready. So once we do all of that and tick those boxes, we can enter into our clinical trial. And our clinical trial has been designed, and it's designed with the Birmingham Clinical Trials Unit at the University of Birmingham, one of the best in the world, especially when it comes to cancer. With the Brain Matrix, the Tessagel Brain Matrix program, one of the best, and across, I think it's 15 of the centers of excellence in the UK. So we're targeting to go into 6 of those, 50 patients. And if we meet our primary outpoints, we've been told that if we do it at the registration grade, then we can get that approved and we get that into patients. So we feel that if we can get this 700,000 and get over that valley of death, then once we're clinical trial ready, a lot of the venture capitalists that we've spoken to have said, come back then, because for them to raise 700,000 isn't worth it. They would rather raise the millions, but they're not going to raise millions while we still have to complete preclinical work. We're not asking for a lot of money. In the grand scheme of pharmaceutical development, 700,000 is a drop in the bucket. And what we believe is we could be in a clinical trial probably within 18 months. And just given how people die with a high-grade glioma, the outcomes are going to probably be seen within 18 months of the start of that study. So within 3 years, we could have a potential new treatment for glioma patients at a cost of probably 5 million, which when you think about other developments, it could be 15 years and it could cost close to $500 million. We really need some sort of high net worth philanthropist to prepare to say, here we go, or come together with others to do so quickly. But I also want to educate kids getting that early STEM interest in development, but I also want to educate patients and families as to what is going on out there. And not all of us are out just to make money. We want to make a difference. So I would like to get involved and try and get the public to understand why this local approach makes sense about our implants. This is as we talk here about chemoseed with Ernotecan in it. Actually, we're developing chemoseed with other drugs in it. We've actually managed to develop a four-layered chemoseed that can deliver four drugs through the resection margin independently. So that if you, this era of personalized medicines, and this is the question I've always asked around personalized medicines. Personalized medicine, particularly in brain tumors, we know is going to require multiple drugs. We're already putting patients through a pretty tough time with one drug. What's it going to be like when we start to give them 2, 3, 4, 5 drugs at high dose to get into the brain? So I love the idea of getting the public involved, and we'll list some of the innovations coming through and maybe sparking the next generation to really think smart and not follow. The problem with pharmaceuticals is we follow what tradition was done in the past. The pandemic should have shown us that actually needed it. We've done the past. We rolled a vaccine out rapid speed because we worked together and we were smart. And we use paper-based exercises to answer some of the regulators' questions. We can do that. We don't always have to do experiments. If the data exists out there, put it together in a package, get the right person who can write it up and sell it to the regulator. They will accept it. They're not these dragons that we all think, they're just saying no when they're there to block everything. No, this has changed. The MHRA have now what's called an innovation passport. It's about speeding up treatments for rare diseases. So that, getting the public to understand that, get involved in that and realize and start questioning, why are you putting funding in that area? Why aren't you focusing on this? What about drug delivery? What about taking a drug that we know is sitting on a shelf somewhere and is cheap and we can reformulate it and deliver it in a different way? So I would like to get that sort of out there in the community, because as I said, the brain tumor community are glued in to treatments, to understanding what's going on. I've sat with these guys with a bit of a presentation that's very much like Blue Peter, real patronizing, and this is what we do. And then the first hand to go up, and I realize, oh, these guys actually know a lot more about this, or maybe a lot more, as much as I do. And I think that is what we're missing. And I'm also translational lead for the Precision Health Technologies Accelerator at Birmingham. It's a big incubator. It's about getting precision medicines into the clinic quickly because it's on campus. It's right beside the QE hospital. So there are their patients, the happening in the university, and we are obviously surrounding areas and then the UK and UK, why we're bringing companies, we're bringing academics together. And what I talk about, when companies come to me and say, Chris, we have this new idea and we want to get it into the clinic. And I say, that's great. You can go to all the conferences and you can talk about it as a scientist. Some people will listen, some people won't. But you need the clinical people to pull. It's why I talk about push-pull of translation to the clinic. You need the people like myself, the researchers, the technology people to push it, but you need the clinical people to pull it. And sometimes to get the clinical people to pull it, you need to get the brain tumor community to say, hold on, we want you to look at this. We want you to consider that. And the only way they can do it is that they have an understanding of what's going on.
Would you say students within brain tumors need a financial push, because trying to find scientists to take on brain tumors is very difficult, it seems.
I would agree. I would agree in terms of, I think your first question to me was why I got in to brain tumors. And I'll be honest, over the years, I have asked that in a negative way. Yeah. But it's been in other areas.
It's difficult.
So I agree with that. We have to encourage. So if somebody sits down with me, so if I have one of my PhD students, you sit down with me about their career, and I would say, what do you want to do? Do you want to be your standard academic and make professor quickly and bring in loads of money, loads of research money, but actually not really publish loads of papers? Then if that's the case, then follow what these people are doing and do that and just put a different spin on what they're doing, and you get money and you be a professor very quick. You want to retire and you can live with yourself as that. If you want to do something different and you want to make a difference, then go and ply out your own area. Look at something like brain tumors. And do something like that where, you know, yes, it's going to be hard. It's going to be tough. You know, you're going to watch your colleagues bring in their £1 million grants really quickly and it'll struggle. But if you hit it off, when you retire, you could say, you know, that implant, that was mine. I done that. And it's a hard, and that's the route I have chosen. But I'm really thick skinned and take a lot of that. And I've seen colleagues who are in antimicrobial resistance and other cancers who started at the same time as me. And they're bringing in, I'm seeing them announcing grants all the time. They're publishing papers. But I know that my finish line will be much better than theirs, because they said those will just be, they're just adding a small drop to the ocean that's already there. It's an area that gets funding. You attach certain things to your grant application, certain keywords. It's more likely going to get funded than others. So you can use all the track record of other people, say, well, they've done this and I'm going to advance it. Whereas I'm going, that hasn't worked. I'm not following that track because it hasn't worked. I'm gonna make my own track. Mm. And that's what we've been trying to do. And yeah, it's tough. So in terms of going back to the young people, I think if we can get funding in there and we can show that actually there is support for this, then more and more will come into this area.
Yes.
But at the minute, it's people that look just say, we see how difficult it is. I'm not going to win the brain tumors. I'm not going to go. Like when I think of how many PhD students I've graduated, I don't know if any of them, I think one or two may not be brain tumor focused. I think maybe one of them or two of them are still in the brain tumor area. The others have went in different directions because they've probably seen how tough it's been for me in trying to raise the money and do things. And it is difficult. So yeah, I think that's, we have to encourage students.
Why is it called Chemoseed?
It was my wife that actually came up with that name. So our drug delivery technology, it's a seed that's implanted in the kit. So chemo, like chemotherapy, and then it's the seed. It was my wife that actually came up with that name. One day sitting on the sofa, was trying to think of a name. And I was looking at them and she just, what are we chemo seed? It took a while for me to get used to, but every time I would have said it to the other team, and everyone, they all loved it. So that's chemo seed. That's a platform, what we call a platform drug delivery technology. Mm-hmm. And the first drug we're investigating to be delivered by chemo seed is AMTCAM, which is an old cancer drug. It's currently used in bowel cancer. And it is sometimes used in brain tumors as a second and third line therapy. It just doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier and it requires high dose and there's lots of toxicity with it. And the reason we chose that drug is because it's already been in the brain. There's only...
How many people do you have in your team?
At the minute, there's four of us. Mm-hmm. So there's a board of four. And then we sponsor PhD students within my lab at Birmingham. So then we use my lab. So we've probably... At one point, I think we had... Four, five patients working on chemoseed. We're down to two at the minute, focusing on chemoseed technologies. Then we have an advisory board of neurosurgeons and oncologists and pharmaceutical manufacturing people, regulatory people as well, who we just, at the minute, we're tapping into some of those for free because they're obviously brain tumor specialists that want to help. Thank you for taking the time to listen to my story.
No, it's really interesting. I'm on the patient side, so we don't hear all of this stuff. So it's actually really interesting to see how what you've gone through or what scientists have gone through to get to help people like me. Thank you very much.
This is the Auntie M Brain Tumors Talk Show. It's a show full of informative chat and inspirational messages. The Auntie M Brain Tumors Talk Show on podcast.